And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, April 29, 2024. A South Sudanese researcher says ethnopolitics is looming in South Sudan's Tomboura County.
And I think the great tragedy there is that two politicians have taken a political contention over the control of the state, a contention between Gemma Nunu, the speaker, and Futio, who is the opposition governor, and they've transposed it onto an ethnic tension. So though Futio actually is half Zande, he's rebranded himself as a Balanda ethno-nationalist.
And an environmentalist says plastic pollution is threatening lives in South Sudan.
That is threatening because I'm inhaling the plastic. Plastic, which is a pollution to my health, and it would actually like maybe have some lung issues in my body. It contributes to the shortage of lifespan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Catholic Church in South Sudan's Western Equatorial State is going through a difficult time. The Bishop of the Yambio Tambura Diocese, Eduardo Kosala Hiboro, says the government of South Sudan should offer protection to civilians in Tomboura who are sheltering at the UN and the compound of the Catholic Church following series of attacks on community leaders in the area. We now go live to Tomboura with Father Mark Kumbonyeki, the parish priest of St. Mary. Father Mark, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yes, welcome to South Sudan in Focus. Since we spoke with you on Friday, what has changed in Tomboura today?
What I can say is that the village are already deserted. People have come all to the IDP camps, those in the barracks, in the church, and the inmates, and the complex. And some are fleeing towards Wau.
And how has this affected the church? I mean, you are in the center of this insecurity. How has it affected the church? I saw a message from Bishop Hiboro Kosala, who was asking the government to protect church personnel and to protect people.
How it has affected that, we have also lost one of our priests, Father Luca Yibwe. He went to Najero. He has been in charge of Najero. As he was coming back on Saturday, then that day there is a road branching going to Namutina. When he reached there, according to what we got yesterday from the soldiers who went to that Nigeria to follow what was happening, he was abducted and taken towards that road going to Namutina. Now we don't know whether he's alive or he's dead. No one has confirmed yet about his whereabouts and whether he's alive or dead.
And so you're telling me there is a priest from the Catholic Church who is in charge of the church in Najero and he's missing?
Yes, he's missing. He went there last week on Saturday to pay the teachers who are teaching the secondary school there of the Catholic Church. On his way on Saturday, reaching halfway, he was abducted and taken. He was on a motorbike with one of the drivers with whom they went together. Up to now, there is no any information about his whereabouts.
This sounds like not good news to the Catholic Church there. And talk to me about the people who are in your compound. How are you feeding them?
We don't have anything to feed them with except what they have brought with them. They are trying to survive on. And likely enough now, they are just surviving on the mangoes. But we don't know when the mangoes will finish now, what they will survive on. Because they just rain when there was this attack on Saturday, Friday night. They just rain, leaving everything in the garden. They cannot go back now to the garden. They are just surviving on mango.
Thank you, Father Mark Kumbonyeki. That was Father Mark Kumbonyeki, the parish priest of St. Mary Catholic Church in Tomboro Town. Waste disposal is a major problem in South Sudan. There are few companies working to manage and keep South Sudan's capital clean as authorities struggle to improve proper management of waste products in Juba. For VOA News, Dennis Longonyi reports from Juba.
As Juba's population continues to grow, waste management has not been able to keep up with piles of trash littering the city. New companies have emerged on the scene to try to help. Taban Isaac, an operation manager at Eco Clean Company, says lack of awareness, greed, and human activities are to blame for the growing waste pollution in the city. Isaac says Eco Clean collects trash from houses and companies in the towns of Juba, Torit, Bor, Wau, and Yambio. But one of the main collection points is Juba's biggest market.
Konyokonyo is producing more waste than any other market in Juba because there is congestion in Konyokonyo in terms of business. We also have families, individuals also, they produce waste. They don't spend their own money for paying for those people who are collecting waste from the houses. They just bring and put them on the road so that it can be taken freely. So this is actually the mentality that our people have in South Sudan. They bring them, collect them from their houses, then bring and dump it on the road, on the main roads.
May 3rd is the World Press Freedom Day, and this year's theme is A Rest for the Planet, Journalism in the Face of the Environmental Crisis, dedicated to the importance of journalism and freedom of expression in the context of the current global environmental crisis. The United Nations says awareness of the global environmental crisis and its consequences is essential for building democratic societies and that journalistic work is indispensable for this purpose. The UN says journalists encounter significant challenges in seeking and disseminating information on contemporary issues such as supply chains problems, climate migration, extractive industries, illegal mining, pollution, and poaching. Isaac says the government has improved waste management by involving other stakeholders.
There are some individuals that reside very close to the streams. People get advantage of that stream of being close to them. Instead of getting a right source of taking this waste out so that it can be taken to dumping site, they throw all this waste into the stream. And when rain comes, the rain will take all this waste to the river.
Men Mabior Men, also known as Many Men, is a local musician and founder of Anataban, a civil society organization that uses art to campaign for a clean Juba. Many Men says more must be done to remind people about the benefits of living in a clean city.
And the initiative was to make sure the wider society adopts the idea or decision to be able to clean up the streets or perhaps the communities around them. But at the end of the day, I feel that it is a responsibility for each and every citizen to be able to take the cleaning as a mandate to be able to practice around the neighborhood.
The Juba City Council terminated contracts of three waste management companies last week, citing lack of capacity to operate in the city. An official who refused to be mentioned for fear of reprisal says the council should invest in waste management projects.
Everything it is state money, my friend. To clean the place is a dangerous thing. Every work needs to be clean, either your house. If you don't have the money, you cannot clean it well.
Mario Toby Andrea, who works as a trainer at the Japanese International Cooperation Agency, says waste management has always been a challenge in South Sudan.
If you see our people here, most of them, they used to burn their waste because they don't have a place where this waste should be taken. 4 or 5 months ago, there's a three dump truck given by JICA to Juba City Council. Those three dump truck was being divided into the three blocks, Juba, Kator, and Munike, to start in a project called Fee Collection Pilot Project, whereby they can collect garbage fee from the resident household to household.
Lueth Renglues, an environmentalist with the non-profit Community Action Against Plastic Waste South Sudan. He says plastic is the biggest contributor to waste here. To overcome the challenge, he says lawmakers should enact environmental laws.
For us to minimize waste pollution in South Sudan, the waste must be banned. We have to put what we call plastic bag bans. This reduces the amount of the waste, for example, the plastic bags that come into the country. Another policy that government of South Sudan put in place is the plastic bag tax, because if they are heavily taxed, the people who bring them will now have no profit to make.
Bataria Maror Maker, deputy chair of Environment Committee at the reconstituted Transition National Legislature, Legislative Assembly says lawmakers are working on environmental policies, especially waste pollution.
We're going to cooperate with the Central Equatorial Government, the City Council, and local government. We are going to sit with them to make sure the whole capital is clean.
If emissions from waste disposal continue to increase around the world, the experts say climate will not only be negatively impacted, but human health as well. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonye reporting from Juba.
Still on environmental crisis, environmentalists in South Sudan say there is widespread plastic pollution in the country. Koki Haviat, an environmental expert, says South Sudanese are not aware of the dangers of plastic pollution. Juba City Council officials say they are working very hard to collect plastic from the capital. Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Smoke from burning plastic can be seen billowing out from a garbage dump near Konyokonyo Market in Juba. Some Juba residents say they are worried about their health because of the amount of smoke from burned plastic. Jacob Ball shares his concerns.
That is threatening because I'm inhaling the plastic. Plastic, which is a pollution to my health, and it would actually like maybe have some lung issues in my body. It contribute to the shortage of lifespan. Our parent would live for a long time because of this modern life where people burn plastic. It is cutting our lifespan, and it is causing more disease. Says, I'm worried about my life every day.
Thomas Abuni sells clothes a few meters from the Konyokonyo dam site. He says he's exposed to smoke pollution every day.
The smoke from the burning plastic is terrible. Breathing it in has been causing a lot of cough, and this cough can be dangerous. I call on the government to take this plastic waste to another place far from people.
Some environmental experts in South Sudan say there is widespread plastic pollution in the country. Environmentalist Kiko Abbott says South Sudan is already facing some consequences from plastic pollution.
These plastic products, they are causing air pollution, especially when they are burnt. And to some extent, it might lead to the global warming. I remember even some past months ago, we experienced such the overheating. I believe also you witness in Juba. This one also contributes to climatic change in South Sudan. For example, those waste products, you can see a lot of plastic materials. Once it rains, all those things go to the river. And at the end of it, it is lead to flooding in other states.
He calls on the transitional government to combat plastic pollution. Flora Gabriel Modi, mayor of Juba City Council, says her office has employed people to collect plastic waste from the street of Juba. She says, however, her office still faces challenges in controlling widespread plastic pollution in the city.
People are not even taking it serious. Even if we collect, they have a habit of throwing these bottles outside their cars and even when they are working. But we are controlling and we are checking it. We have actually a public order about it. So if you caught somebody who is throwing it, we have to fine him. We are looking for a recycling company to take it over so that it can help, so that when we take the bottles, we have to recycle it.
She says the lack of a recycling company has forced her office to resort to burning plastic materials despite the air pollution it causes. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The one-year conflict in Sudan is having its side effects felt in South Sudan. Researchers familiar with the two countries say the conflict will add more suffering on the people of South Sudan.
What do you think?
With me in the studio here, I have two guests who are researchers, and they have written extensively on Sudan and South Sudan. To my right is Joshua Cruz, who has been writing extensively on issues to do with the proliferation of weapons in South Sudan and other areas in Africa. He has worked with several organizations, including the UN, Rift Valley Institute, and others. And to my left is Raghav Makawi, who is also a researcher who has written extensively about her country, Sudan. And today, both of them are going to talk to us about issues that are very close to our listeners in Sudan and South Sudan. Joshua, welcome to Voice of America.
It's great to be back. It's been 10 years and two civil wars since I was last here, John.
And talk to us about the situation in South Sudan. As far as I know, the country has been put on arms embargo since 2018, and there's a lot going on there. Let us start with the latest. Tombora is not peaceful. A lot of families have taken refuge at the Onmis compound and church compound because of insecurity. During some of your visits in South Sudan, you've done a lot of research on intercommunal violence. Talk to us about that.
So I was in Western Equatoria last year, and I think the great tragedy there is that two politicians have taken a political contention over the control of the state, a contention between Djemanounou, the speaker, and Futio, who is the opposition governor, and they've transposed it onto an ethnic tension. So though Futio actually is half Zande, he's rebranded himself as a Balanda ethno-nationalist, and he's tried to say we need to worry about the Zande. And Djemanounou's got really worried, and she's all trying to organise as a Zande politician. So you see people instrumentalise their ethnic differences, and that's created a total touch paper in Western Equatoria, where my Zande friends tell me they're too scared to even mention that they actually like Futio.
And the Speaker of the National Legislative Assembly, Nunu Djemakumba, wrote a statement disputing some of your findings in Western Equatoria, and she actually said yours was character assassination.
Djemanounou did write a piece disputing some of the claims, but actually if you go through the letter, the claims are well-founded. She has known to play the role which was agreed by the UN panel of experts, by the UN Human Rights Division in the fermenting of the violence that broke out in 2021 in Tambora County. And we see at the moment that there has been, it is just true, the recruitment of militia forces on the border with Congo. We have the formation of a Zande militia in Car. We have...
Central African Republic.
That's Central African Republic. Thank you, John. Sorry. And we have the SSPDF and the opposition patrolling separately in the Ambio town at the end of the year. And we have, as Gemma herself would acknowledge, a consistent dispute between Futio and herself. She is, of course, thinks that I am a Futio supporter. Unfortunately, if you read the report, you'll see I am just as critical of Alfred Karabo Futio, the governor, as I am of Djemanounou. I take no side in this fight. I just think it's a tragedy that conflict has been ethnicized in Western Equatoria.
We will come back to the issues of this conflict and where these people are getting their arms from, because the country is under arms embargo. Let me come to Raga here. I did not forget you. And Sudan, where you come from, is on fire.
That is
and
true.
There are people that I've lived with in Sudan, friends who are there. I've lost contact with them. That conflict has also affected me, just like you. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about what other people don't know that you know about the problem in Sudan, based on your research, based on some of the writings that you have penned down on the origin of this conflict and who is helping who in this crisis.
Right. And for those who don't know, Sudan is now considered the largest displacement crisis in the world. It is also a place where almost, 100% of children of school-going age who are out of school at the moment. These are, ridiculous numbers that we're talking about. There's also a situation where famine is looming, even though it's not declared. We're talking about a population that has been under siege for more than a year now, where there is no access whatsoever to health services and the rudimentary infrastructure that already existed in the country is being decimated, either by the lack of servicing, whether by the state or any form of service provider, whether it was international, the community, or kind of, you know, internal business. The same kind of extends to the issue of supply chains. How are the Sudanese people eating? Where do they get, you know, their daily rations from?
And somebody also say, where do they get their weapons from?
That is
RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, the Sudan Armed Forces seem to be well armed. And they're fighting each other. Even some of them are using drones. Mm-hmm. And these are not, if you like, equipment that you can easily lay your hands on. Mm-hmm. It involves money. Who is supporting who? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of the crisis of the era we're living in, that there is kind of, you know, money available, but also kind of accessible routes to bring in weapons, but not food and medicine for those who need it the most. In the case of the RSF, the regional backers continue to be the United Arab Emirates. In the past, they provided them with, at some point, it used to be kind of military and financial support.
Some equipment.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But now, and even more dangerous, I think, in my opinion, is the political backing that the UAE is attempting to give the RSF by providing a platform, an in-house platform in the UAE for the civilians. Obviously, because of what's been happening in Sudan and the way that the violence has kind of been developed or kind of evolving, and the direct effect on the population, fears around, you know, the legitimacy of the RSF moving forward, even should they win this war, required some sort of political kind of backing or political project to underpin, you know, the fighting.
And how about Burhan? Where does he get his equipment from? Mm. I mean, Sudan Armed Forces has been fighting mm-hmm. in its 60 years or 100 years of existence. Mm-hmm. They fought two wars in southern Sudan, what was then southern Sudan, and then in Darfur, mm. they fought for quite a long time there. Mm. But who is backing Burhan right now?
I mean, Burhan and SAF is part of an extended kind of military rule project in which historically they've been tied to, you know, countries like Egypt, but also by extension Turkey and Iran. You know, kind of in this kind of problematic geopolitical contentious back and forth, mm-hmm. it's not difficult for someone like Burhan to get the necessary military backup should he need it, and for some, you know,
yeah,
for concessions that are to be determined possibly or kind of understood better later. But both Burhan and Hemeti as well at some point did sit on a major kind of military manufacturing kind of industry or complex in Sudan, right? I mean, Jihad, the company, did invest mm-hmm. in producing weapons and military equipment locally. And that was part of the reason, right, that drove the kind of divide, right? And basically what kind of drove this conflict.
Yeah.
Was a disagreement over both economic and military spoils that both the RSF and SAF had partnered on during, you know, the 4 years prior to...
Yes. And just hold your thoughts on that. Let me go to Joshua and ask him about supplies of weapons in the region. And the focus here is in South Sudan. This country has been on arms embargo. You were telling me that there is a difficult or very serious situation in Western Equatoria, where ethnicity is bringing up its ugly head and it's fueling intertribal conflict. Where do these people get their arms from?
Well, John, as you know, there's been two 20-year-long civil wars in Sudan and the country is full of guns. One of the things that is really hampering South Sudan right now is an enormous economic crisis, runaway inflation. The government's abandoned even the pretense of paying salaries. And so what do soldiers do? they sell their weapons and they sell their guns. So if you look at the violence in Jonglé, excuse me, there's a flourishing market in weapons from the soldiers. So we can't really talk seriously about the formation of a national unified army under the terms of the peace agreement until we talk seriously about the fact that the government doesn't have the capacity, it doesn't have the political will to pay soldiers it's not interested in paying. So, and if you don't get your guns and your weapons from the army, well, all of South Sudan's borders are incredibly porous, and every country is locked into different civil wars. You can go, if you're in Western Equatoria, to DRC, which, of course, has flows of guns coming into the country from including Rwanda-backed militias, M23, and a variety of other backed militias. Or you could go to CAR, Central African Republic, just across the border,
you have the Seleka and the others.
And you also have the Russians, right, who are supplying weapons and arms to the RSF from CAR going north to Sudan. So there is absolutely no shortage of different regional conflicts bringing arms into the region, and there's a crisis of employment and of poverty which creates weapons markets. Well, if you go to the north of South Sudan, you know, in this area, sort of northern Bahr Ghazal, Upper Nile, they used to be reliant on Khartoum, on Sudan, for food, for supplies. All of that was broken by the war, but it was replaced by something, which are markets in stolen goods and markets in weapons from people coming north. And so now some of the fighting and contestations in Unity State, in places like Riak, is around who controls these markets of stolen goods. So we see the economics of one war producing the economics of another potential war in the south.
That's Joshua Cruz, a researcher for several organizations, and Raga Makawe, who were with me in the studio earlier today. And that brings us to the end of our show for today. I'm your host, John Tanza, and on behalf of our producer, Gwen Utun, and Chang, Engineer Chang, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
1 year ago, two rival generals sent their armies into battle and set Sudan on a path of death, destruction, and devastation. Today, the fighting continues to rage, noted Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs at the United Nations.
We have all seen the reports of gang rape and mass murder at the hands of Rapid Support Forces militias, of women and girls being sold into sexual slavery, and boys forced to be child soldiers, of snipers indiscriminately targeting civilians, and militias slaughtering entire villages in Darfur. War has turned Sudan into a living hell. Nearly 25 million Sudanese people are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Three quarters of them face acute food insecurity.
Ambassador Wood called on both General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Lieutenant General Mohamed Hamdan, who leads the country's rapid support forces, to negotiate in good faith and cease further offensives.
Let's be clear. The two warring generals, who together led a military takeover in 2021, upending Sudan's democratic transition, are still standing in the way of a better future for the people of Sudan. Today I say to them, end this senseless war once and for all. Clearly, further pursuit of outright military victory only adds to an already staggering human cost.
The people of Sudan need more humanitarian assistance, and they need it now, stressed Ambassador Wood.
The people of Sudan are facing a crisis of epic proportions, with famine imminent. Yet, humanitarian organizations have not been allowed to deliver much-needed assistance. Unhindered humanitarian access must be allowed. Full stop. Humanitarian personnel must not be targeted or harassed as they try to meet critical needs of Sudanese civilians.
The United States is the largest donor of humanitarian aid to the region and has provided more than $1 billion since 2023, including the recent announcement of an additional $100 million to alleviate the humanitarian crisis in Sudan. Ultimately, Sudan's civilians should define Sudan's path going forward and restore the democratic transition they began and sacrificed for. The U.S. will continue to bring to the world's attention the plight of the Sudanese people and work to hold those responsible to account.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.